The Asian Classics Institute presents Lojung, Developing the Good Heart, with Geshe Michael Roach, recorded live in New York City in June of 1998. This is the beginning of Class 10.
Sanshi Bhurki Jushin Leto Shang Rira Vinshi Nyende Yampati Sangye Shindu Mitte Uwagi Jogu Namda Shingla Shubhashu Gidam Ranamata Kamiyatayami Sangye Chadam Sangye Chonama Chanchu Badu Dagni Kapsuchi Dagi Chunyen Dibe Sunamki Dora Penche Sangye Chupasho Sangye Chadam Sangye Chonama Chanchu Badu Dami Kapsuchi Dagi Chumyen Dibe Sunamki Jola Penche Sangye Jupasho Sangye Chudam Sangye Chodama Chanchu Badu Dami Suchi Dahi Chunyen Kibbe Sunamki Yola Penche Sangye Juvashu.
Okay, we've been studying a Lojong text, Lojong, How to Develop a Good Heart, and we've been studying one of the most famous ones. It's called Tsuncha Korlo. Say Tsuncha. Korlo. Tsuncha. Korlo. Sometimes, those of you studying Tibetan, sometimes it's Tsunche Korlo. Tsuncha means any kind of weapon in general, like a Duten Tsuncha is an atomic bomb. But more specifically in this case, it means something with a sharp blade. And we talked about it last time that we're talking about like a ninja star about this big, and it's got these sharp blades, razor blades coming out the side like knives, sharpened on both sides. And the idea is that you could throw it at somebody. And I guess it's like a boomerang, you know, like you throw it that way, and then you're just innocently standing there, and then suddenly something slashes you on the head over here. Whoa! And you don't know quite what happened, you know. And this is the story of your life, you know, every unpleasant, I mean, it's the unpleasant things when you say, why did this happen to me, or why me? And people don't wonder about the good things, they wonder about the bad things. So it's like, why am I having this bad thing happening to me? And it's very important, last time, the whole first half of this book, first, what does he do? He bows down to the three jewels. Secondly, what does he do? In the middle of a Lojong text, he bows down to a tantric fire angel called the Lord of Death, Yamari. Okay? And then he starts this sweet little Lojong text about, it seems like every time that something bad happens to me, if I really analyze it, I see that it came from myself, that I did something to hurt somebody, and there's this long boomerang thing, and then it comes back and hurts me. Okay? And I think, and then he goes through a long, long list of, this happened to me, my boss yelled at me, oh, this is the wheel of sharp knives coming back and hitting me. I realized it was because I yelled at someone else before. From now on, I'll never yell back at my boss. Okay, like that. It's a whole cycle of having something bad happen to you, figuring out what it was that you did before, and then deciding how to avoid doing it anymore. And this is the whole, we're going to do the wheel of life in the next course. And the key of the wheel of life is that at number one, at 1 o'clock, you can break the wheel of life. That's the whole point of samsara. when someone's bad to you, and you get angry, and you want to do something back to them, if you break it at that point called ignorance, if you understand that it's coming from you, and if you respond with the same stuff, it will perpetuate this thing, then you're free. Then slowly you can get free of everything, all the trouble you have. But it's very compelling to think that it's other people's fault, especially when the suffering is coming back to you through a human being. You know, if a brick falls on your head, or an egg, or whatever, walking down the street. We were walking down the street the other night, had a nice latte, and then right in the middle of 6th Street, this egg lands on my head. And I'm not kidding. And I think they threw it off a roof. Like it felt like a brick. It hurt. It really hurt. And we were sitting there and laughing. You know, you never know, you know. It's easy to be, like if you stub your toe or something, it's easy to kind of forget it and not to worry about it and not to believe too much in the self-existence of it. But when somebody is there in front of your face and somebody right in front of you is hurting you somehow, it's almost impossible at that moment to realize that this is coming from yourself and that they are just an instrument of energy that you set in motion yourself. They have nothing to do with the bad thing happening to you. There's nothing you can do by reacting to them to stop it. There's no connection between what you say to them or what you do to them or any kind of logic or any kind of anger. There's no connection to that. It's all coming to you because of something you did before. And if you do the right thing now, it'll go away. And if you do the wrong thing now, it'll keep coming. And you don't need to know any more than that to reach nirvana. That's enough to reach nirvana. You have to study karma. You have to understand how things are planted in your mind. And then everything is clear, and then you know what you have to do, and you really don't need much more dharma than that. You want to get out of the bad situations in your life. Every single physical and mental pain that you, every unpleasant thing that happens to you throughout the day, and they happen all day long, right? Every 5 minutes or so. It's all coming from you. You have to get used to that. And that's what the first half of the Lojong is about. You know, the whole first half of the Lojong is, oh, this is happening to me. I must have done that. In the future, I won't do this anymore. You know, one of the students made a very beautiful chart. You'll get it with this reading of all of those verses. You know, they put problem, somebody's yelling at me, or problem, I get migraine headaches. What was it really caused by? I didn't keep the vows I took when I was with a lama or something like that. How shall I fix it? I won't do that anymore. I'll now keep my vows, you know, or something like that. They actually made a whole chart of everything, so it's kind of cool. And as I mentioned last time, it's very important to say, especially if you weren't here, if you have a problem with someone yelling at you all the time, it's because you yelled at other people in the past. That's the real cause. Okay? Does that mean that you are necessarily a yeller in this life? No. Okay? And you gotta get used to that. Okay? You may be the most quiet, simple, nice person in this life who never yells at anybody. But it doesn't mean that you don't have that old karma. And that old karma people can be yelling at you all day. So how are you supposed to fix it if you're not a yeller? You see what I mean? What are you supposed to do now? You have to be even more careful than normal people about saying unkind things to other people. That's all. Okay, got it? That's how you stop it. And if you read the first half of the Wheel of Knives last time, if you finished and read it, you already know what your particular problem is, you know what was causing it. Now you in particular, whether it's a backache or a headache or depression or feeling upset or being jealous a lot or something like that, mental or physical problems, now you have enough information. You have to stop that particular thing that you saw on the chart there. So you're going to get a chart during the break, okay? You personally have to be super careful about yelling even the tiniest bit, okay, because you have that problem and you need to purify that old karma. And the most powerful way to purify it is to avoid it even in the smallest instance, okay? And now you know everything you need to know. You don't need to know more than that, okay? That was the first half of the Wheel of Knives, okay? Now we get to a sudden break, and I warned you about it last time, okay? He's been moaning and groaning about the Wheel of Knives. He's been saying, I did that, it circled around, I had this kind of bad things happening to me, and I'm and I'm not going to do that again. Oh, and I also had this problem, and I got this problem, and this problem, and this problem. And he goes through verse after verse after verse, and he identifies the problem, and he says, I'm not going to do that anymore. And then he's getting, if you feel the verses, he's getting uptight. You know, he's starting to get riled up. And in the beginning, he was talking about this tantric deity. You know, he's like saying, Lord of death, you know, we're going to get to the Lord of death here sooner or later. This is where we get to it, okay? We're at the point in the where his whole mood changes, you know? He's not like this poor guy who's getting migraines, who's trying to figure out where they come from. Now he gets mad, you know, and he says, wait a minute, let's figure out why this is happening to me. You know, what is the root cause of all this stuff? I understand that it's all because I yelled at somebody. I understand it was all because I hurt somebody. But what made me do that, you know? Did the devil make me do that? Who made me do that? You see what I mean? Who's making me do that? And then he looks inside himself, okay? And he's starting to get angry because he's starting to figure out who makes him do that. You know, there is something making him do that. And then suddenly at this point in the text, you're going to get it in the reading. There's 50 more pages of reading, okay? And suddenly at this moment in the text, he gets mad. And he like changes into this fierce Lord of death, okay? So since I'm not very good at being mad publicly, I do it all inside. I decided to call on a consultant. David Sykes. And he's going to read some of these verses one by one, just so you can get the true feeling, because I'm too shy, okay? And he's got to be the Lord of death, okay? So you got to see the Lord of death here. He's got these... Apparently he keeps his legs like that, you know, and he's holding... You got your thing? Where's your thing? He's got this chat knife. Come on, I mean, they don't hold it like that. It's like... No. Yeah, that's better, that's better. And he's looking at you like that. And you got to stare with hatred in your eyes, okay? Come on. Okay, hatred in your eyes and 2 feet. What was the other thing? Okay, anyway, we'll see. All right. He's going to... This is the... Are you ready?
I got no mic. Okay, now I got it.
Okay, this is the crucial moment when the author of this Lojong, Dhammarakshita, the teacher of Lord Atisha, suddenly he figures out who's been giving him all the grief. He says, now I know. And... David Sykes is going to do it, okay? Just verse number one, okay?
Since this is the way things are, I've finally realized just who my enemy is. I've caught the thief who lay in wait and deceived me with his trap. He's a masquerader, fooling others and fooling himself as well. I see it now. He's the habit I have of cherishing myself, of grasping to myself, and of this there can be no doubt.
Okay. Could you understand that, okay? Yeah. Okay, anyway, he figures out who it is, and he starts to get mad, and he starts to change into another person. You see, the author starts to change into another person, and he's like getting very, very angry at his own self, at himself. And there are two states of mind here, okay? Say Rang Chenzin. Rang Chenzin. Then Dang Jin. Dang Jin. Okay, these are... very similar, and they're often confused, and you have to learn to separate them, okay? Rang means yourself. Che means, Chen Zin is a verb that means to cherish yourself, self-cherishing, okay? Watching out for number one. That's called Rang Chen Zin. The state of mind that watches out for number one. Dang Zin is something different, and it looks at yourself. It focuses on yourself. In the kind that gives you trouble, okay? There's a couple of kinds. The kind that gives you trouble is the kind that looks at yourself and doesn't understand the emptiness of you, okay? It's a misunderstanding of the emptiness of you. Dang means self-nature. Zin means it grasps, it believes that you have some existence from your own side, okay? Dang Zin means the state of mind where you believe something has some existence from its own side. How does it deal to in a case? How does it relate to a case in which your boss is yelling at you, or another person is doing something bad to you, Where's the Shen, where's the Rang Jianjin, and what's the Dang Jin? Okay, what's the difference between self-cherishing and misunderstanding yourself? Okay, and then you'll be able to get out of it. And this is the one, he's like, I'm going after you, you know. You want, I'm sick of this ninja wheels slashing my head. Would you like to see how it feels? And like, you can see him almost grabbing it out of the guy's hands. And he's like this, and he's like, would you like it on your head now? Let's see how you like it, Mr. Dong Chenzin. Let's see how you like it, Mr. Dong Chenzin. And then he gives it to him, you know, and he's this brutal, when you read it, he's like Mike Tyson out of control. Like he'd bite his ear or something, you know. And he's like, he's going out of control and he starts slashing at his, he realizes who his real enemy is, okay? In the case of the boss screaming at you, Rang Chenzin is the one who's focusing very much on, I'm unhappy at this moment, you know? It doesn't care about anybody else in the room. It's focusing on me. It's focusing on what's happening to me, okay? And it's ignoring the other people in the room. When you have a mental affliction, oftentimes, an automatic result is that your charity towards other people, thinking about other people's suffering, thinking about other people's troubles, disappears right away. And Rang Chenzin comes, you know, like, I'm not getting what I want, you know? And that's the first state of mind, okay? I'm more important than everybody else here, and this guy's yelling at me. Okay, that's Rang Chenzin. Dang Zin is much more subtle. Dang Zin is focusing on this situation and doesn't get it that it's not coming from the boss. Okay? Big difference, right? Rang Chenzin is like, I'm having a bad time. I'm having a bad day, and doesn't think about other people. But Dang Zin is the root of that emotion. Dang Zin is saying, is looking at this and saying, the boss is the cause of this problem. He's yelling at me. He's a bad person. I hate him. Okay? That's Dang Zin. Dang Zin doesn't understand what? That this is all coming from you. Okay? Prove it. That boss's wife loves him. That boss's wife swears he's the nicest person in the world. Okay? Other people in the room think the boss is doing exactly the right thing when they're yelling at you. Okay? Obviously, if he's a really bad person, it's not coming from his side. It's coming from somewhere else. If it was coming from his side, everybody else in the room would be feeling the same thing about him, and they don't. Okay? Something else is happening. What's happening? Your karma is making you experience this situation as unpleasant. Okay? Dang Zin can't figure that out. Chen Zin is worried about me. Okay? Why is it happening to me? But Dang Zin is at the root of it all. Dang Zin doesn't understand that if you just shut up, the boss won't come back anymore. Okay? That's a big difference. These are both the enemy. Okay? When he starts slashing the enemy, he's going after these two states of mind. Okay? Next, the next verse, two verses, are going to be number two and number three. Okay? It's going to be a description of what he turns into, okay? This guy, this nice old Dhammarakshita, who's just figured out who's giving him all the trouble, is going to undergo a transformation. Okay, here we go. Ready?
Now let's see the wheel of knives, of karma. Cut his skull, O angel of wrath. Now cut his skull, cut thrice. Stand like a god on widespread legs, a knowledge of two truths. Stare in hatred with two eyes, of method and of wisdom. Open your jaws and show your fangs. Four powers of confession, seek them deep within the flesh of this my hated foe. I call on the king of the secret knowledge and secret words that work to torture all these enemies. There is no freedom here in the woods of the vicious circle of life. Take up in your hands the wheel of knives. Take up in the... up the wheel of karma, speed to the side of my foe, the cruel one, evil demon that he is, this grasping to myself, broken vows and promises, waster of my life and others, go and fetch him here.
Yeah, okay. So like he's turning into this tantric deity, and he's like talking to this tantric deity, Yamini, and he's saying, okay, go get him, and we'll teach him a lesson, and we will use the same knives on him. Okay? We'll take those two states of mind and and we'll see how they like the wheel of karma, okay, the wheel of knives, and we'll try it on him. Okay, it goes like this. Cut his skull, angel of wrath, cut his skull, cut thrice. Stand like a god on widespread legs. This is a posture that Yamini takes, you know, and Yamini is like this, you know. So Yamini has these, it's called dipa. It's the legs are spread out like that, okay? And Dhammarakshita says, this stands for a knowledge of the two truths, okay? This stands for a knowledge of the two realities. There are two realities going on all the time. All the time around you, two different realities are going on. One is called Kunzop Denpa. Say Kunzop Denpa. Kunzop Denpa. You can think of it as the world created by your projections. Okay? It's the sum total of all the projections you are having. And you call it yourself and your world. Okay? It's the sum total of all the karmic stuff ripening in your mind and making you see this world, all your friends, and your own mind and your own body and yourself. When you look in the mirror in the morning, that's part of Kunzop Denpa. Kunzop Denpa means deceptive reality or false reality. People have translated it as relative truth. That's a wimpy translation. Kunzop doesn't have anything to do with relative. Kunzop means liar, cheater, deceiver, okay? And what it means is the nature of this reality around you is deceptive. You can call it deceptive reality. Okay? Sometimes they call it the two truths. And there's a joke in the monastery that the two truths ain't true. Okay? There's a big joke in the monastery. Hey, the two truths aren't true, right? Right. One is Kunzop. Kunzop means fake truth. False truth. Okay? Why? Because the world as you perceive it now, you're always misled by it. It's always deceiving you. Especially when your emotions are involved. Okay? When the boss starts to yell, he suddenly transforms into something which must be self-existent, existing from his own side. He cannot be my projection caused by my own deeds. He must be a bad person. He must be bad from his side. It can't be something that I'm doing. Okay? That's a sign. That's Kunzop Denpa. Okay? And everything around you, all of the what we call appearances, which means your projections going on constantly, those are called deceptive reality. Okay? The other reality is called Dundam Denpa. Say Dundam Denpa. Dundam Denpa. Dundam Denpa means the fact that nothing is not your projection. Got it? The fact that nothing exists any other way except your projections. You can call it emptiness. Same thing. I'll say it one more time. Emptiness and the fact that there ain't nothing which is not coming from you are the same thing. That's the same thing. And it's called Dundam Denpa. Dundam Denpa means ultimate reality. Okay? Ultimate reality. Ultimate truth. When do you see Dundam Denpa directly? Only once. When you perceive emptiness directly. Tonglam, path of seeing. 20 minutes of direct communion with ultimate reality. That's Dundam Denpa. You can understand it as I speak. You are perceiving it with mental projections as we speak. But that's your projection of ultimate reality and not ultimate reality itself. Okay? You are perceiving it in a way, but you're not perceiving it directly. Okay? On the day that you see emptiness directly for the first time, you will see for the first time that there is a separate reality going on all around us that you never saw before. B, it's a higher reality. Okay? It's a perfect, crystal, empty, diamond reality going on all around you, and you can't make contact with it unless you see emptiness directly. And that understanding can stop you from reacting negatively ever again. You're on the way to stopping your mental afflictions permanently. And that's in fact the definition of nirvana. When you can stop your bad thoughts because you saw emptiness directly. Okay? So, anyone who has a true grasp of this fact, these two realities, they can go and start ripping up these two guys with their wheel of knives. You know, it's like a switchblade or something. You know, anybody who stands on this foundation of these two truths, they got the equipment to start ripping this guy's face out with this knife. Okay? Who's this guy? My own cherishing of myself and not understanding reality. Okay? Once I'm standing on the two legs of my understanding of emptiness and the way the world is happening through my karmic projections, then I'm in a strong position to start ripping this guy's face out. All right? That's the first quality of this tantric deity. What's the second one? He says, stare in hatred with your two eyes. Apparently I can't do it, okay? The guy's like, okay. And he says the two eyes are method and wisdom, okay? Say, tup. Shut up. Oh, by the way, there's two truths, okay? Denyi. And here's tup and shut up. Tup is misspelled here. There's supposed to be a sa here. Say, tup. She. Tup. She. Tup refers, tup means skillful means or method, okay? Method. And it refers generally to the bodhisattva activities, okay? Especially, for example, in the six perfections, it would be like the first four. Giving, living an ethical way of life, learning to overcome anger, and then finally, taking a great joy in doing good deeds, okay? And that kind of behavior is mostly on the tup side of things, okay? It's mostly on the what we call the method side of things. It's more practice and less theory, okay? It's more practice and less theory. Those kinds of energies will create your physical body of an enlightened being in the future, okay? When your body starts to change, when the inner body is, everything starts getting straightened out, and as a result of that, your outer body starts to change and eventually turns into light. This is all because of tup, okay? It's mainly because of your success in the perfections of a bodhisattva, okay? Like those that I mentioned. The practical side of things. Then there's shirab. Say shirab. Shirab. Shirab is wisdom, which only means exactly everything I talked about tonight so far. That's shirab, nothing else. Okay? Understanding emptiness and how your karma is making you see stuff. Okay? What's the emptiness of the boss? He's not a bad guy from his own side, and he's not a good guy from his own side. What's his dependent origination? If I have good karma, I see him as smiling at me. If I have bad karma, I see him as yelling at me. You may have noticed, it doesn't depend what I do. It doesn't matter what I do. You know? I can do something really bad, he comes in and smiles at me. I can have a really good day at work, he comes in and yells at me. Something else is making this happen. Okay? And that's, the knowledge of that is shirab. Shirab is responsible for you eventually achieving the state of mind of a Buddha, as opposed to the body of the Buddha. Okay? The state of mind of a Buddha. And that's mainly the last two perfections, meditation and wisdom. Okay? That's tapshe. So what do we got so far? We got this tantric monster. He's standing on the leg of his understanding of the two truths. He's staring at who? He's staring at his own selfishness and his own self-existent grasping with those two eyes, you know. The six perfections in those two eyes. Okay, those are his two eyes. Okay, this is very typical. I'm not supposed to tell you. Well, I won't. Okay. Open your jaws and show your fangs, four powers of confession. Okay? He's got two fangs here and two fangs here. All right? Sink them deep within the flesh of this my hated foe. Doesn't sound like a sweet little Lojong text, right? You say, could you take a big bite out of this guy? You know, okay? With your fangs. He's got these four fangs, okay? And the fangs are the ability to straighten out your old bad karma. And that's called the four forces, right? And you guys know them. I don't have to go over them, right? There are four tricks to removing your old bad karma, okay? If you have wisdom and method, you can take care of your future karma. If you have a knowledge of the two truths, you can take care of your mental afflictions. You still got to polish off your old bad karma. You can take care of that with the four forces. You are a complete tantric monster. Okay? Everything's covered. New bad karma is covered. Old bad karma is covered. And wisdom is there, and you're not going to have any more problem anymore doing anything. You are a complete monster ready to rip this guy's eyeballs out. Okay? Of who doesn't understand emptiness and as a result is always being selfish. Okay? And you're now in a position to do that. Okay? Is this something metaphorical? You know, people say, oh, that's a nice metaphor. That's a very beautiful metaphor. I guess those tantric pictures are all metaphors, you know? I guess there's no real people like that. Anyway, he would look weird anyway. Can you see this guy walking down the street, you know? What would people say, even in the East Village, you know? This guy is like 8 feet tall, 4 feet across. You know, when he looks at you, he burns your eyeballs out. You know, he's got these fangs hanging out. And he's walking around with this big knife thing and, you know, waving it. And is it just a metaphor? You see, it seems to be a metaphor. It seems to be this guy, this tantric deity is just, oh, now I get it. You know, all those paintings are just metaphors. There's nobody like that. It's not like there's people wandering around with three eyeballs or something like that, okay? The point is this, it's not a metaphor, okay? It's not a metaphor. That being does exist, okay? And it's created by those spiritual qualities existing within you. Okay? Got it? There are monsters like that. There are tantric deities like that. And they are not made of flesh and bone. They are made of projections. And you can have those projections if you get those spiritual realizations. You see what I mean? Like everything else, all tantric deities are produced by your own karma. And the most powerful kind of karma is your own thoughts. And as you begin to have these realizations, you can start to create these guys. They will be created by your own realizations. Okay? Got it? They are made of your realizations. This is not some kind of a metaphor. Okay? If you haven't met a tantric deity lately, it's because you don't have those qualities. You see what I mean? And it doesn't matter how many guys give you initiation and sprinkle water on your head and ring their bell and, you know, and all that. It really doesn't matter much at all. If you have those inside spiritual qualities, you will begin to see these beings because they are made of that. You get it? They are made of your spiritual qualities. You will meet Tara. She will be this extraordinary, lovely, incredible being. But she's made of this kind of stuff that has to come from you. Just as your screaming, stupid, ugly boss is. You see what I mean? And the level of your mind now, the level of your karma now, is that you're creating these bosses who are screaming at you. And every other unpleasant thing you can imagine. If you change the source of that, you would start to run into these angels. You know, like in a restaurant, in a coffee shop. You know, you say, wow. You know, and I'm not talking about, I have students come to me and say, oh, it worked, you know, last week I saw this angel, you know, and I say, well, what were they like, you know, and they say, oh, you know, I tried really hard and I kind of squinted the right way and for 3 minutes or so they seemed like really nice, you know, and I say, well, do you like this person? Yeah, I kind of like him, you know, and then next week they're like, oh, no, the person became a demon, you know, and I'm like, what happened? You know, I don't know. They yelled at me. You know, and it's not like that. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a change in the reality around you, an actual change that stays that way. You know, it's not like thinking of somebody as a tantric angel or thinking of somebody as a demon or something like that. It's that your own karma is forcing you to see them as clearly as the people in this room, and it goes on. It continues to be that way. It's not like a mood you have about somebody or a feeling you have about somebody. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about they actually transform before your eyes. And they stay that way. And that's the whole point of Buddhist practice. So what I'm saying is, the tantric monster being described here, you can become like that. Or you can become like Tara. Or you can, I don't even mean like Tara. You can be Tara. But it comes from practicing year after year these deep things. It comes from keeping your book. It comes from watching your vows. And then slowly things start to change forever. Okay, and that's what I want to say is the tantric deity is not a self-existent external being any more than your boss was. If you're tired of your boss and you'd like to meet these David Sykes, Lord of Death type of guys, you have to change your mind. Okay? All right. Next one. By the way, there's four powers. Wait, not yet. Hold him back. Hold him back. Basically, I mean, if you don't know what the four forces are, ask one of the older students. I don't have time to go into it, but you must learn it. It is how to destroy old bad karma. The essence of it is what we already spoke about. Read the first half of the Wheel of Knives. Figure out your main problems, what caused them karmically, and avoid those perfectly. Avoid the smallest form of that. If you suffer from migraine headaches, and even if you're not the kind of person who breaks their vows, don't even get close, and they'll go away. Okay? And I said last week, if you go to a doctor and they fix you, it's because the old karma ran out, the old bad karma. If you go to a doctor and they can't fix you, it's because the old bad karma didn't wear out. It don't depend on the doctor very much, okay? Not at all, actually. Okay? That's why some medicine works for some people and doesn't work for other people, okay? If there's a vaccination that works for everybody, it's because everybody collected a karma in common or together in the past, okay? You ready, Dr. Sykes? Number four.
Fetch him, bring him, Lord of anger, Lord of death. Strike, strike now, strike the highest foe in his heart with the roar of hell. Smash now the skull of my misperceptions, the ones who have wasted my life. Bring your death to the heart of this butcher, my greatest enemy.
Okay. Okay. It says, fetch him, bring him, Lord of anger, Lord of death. Strike, strike now, strike this highest foe in his heart. And the rest is a refrain, okay? This is going to be in every single verse in the rest of the Lojong, okay? The following is in every verse up to the very end. With the roar of hell, smash now the skull of my misperceptions. The ones who have wasted my life, bring your death to the heart of this butcher, my greatest enemy, okay? And again, now he's asking the monster. You can think of the monster as another person. You can think of Dharma Rakshita becoming the monster. It doesn't matter. You have to become this guy. You have to become this guy. If the mental afflictions were people, and if they looked at you practicing Dharma, you would look like my boss looks to me. Got it? You would look like this monster. Okay? If the mental afflictions were real people, and if you were practicing Dharma really well, if they looked at the Dalai Lama, they would see something really frightening because he's out to kill them. You see what I mean? And if you're practicing well and they see you coming, they're like really, if you look to them like Freddy or something, you know, you look very frightening. If you're practicing well, you look disgusting to a mental affliction, okay? And they're afraid of you, okay? Now he says, smash their skull. Okay, he's mad that these guys have been throwing wheels of knives at him for his whole life, all day long, his whole life. He's been getting hit by these things and never knowing what was the problem. Now he figured it out. It's selfishness and misperceptions. And he says, smash the skull of misperceptions. Okay, Tokpa. Say Tokpa. Tokpa. This is a tricky word, okay, when you're debating in the monastery. Somebody says, Tokpa yinpe yinche. And then suddenly everybody's quiet, and the guy goes up to him and says, is that with a sa or without a sa? Okay, sa is like a special letter at the end of this word, okay? There are two words that are homonyms, like the word two. How do you spell two? I mean, it could be either T-O or T-O-O or T-W-O. When you hear Tokpa in a debate, you always stop the guy and say, wait a minute, which Tokpa Okay, there's two dopas. You gotta get that, okay? The one that has the extra sa on it, if you're studying Tibetan, means high spiritual realization. It's a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful thing. Okay? Dopa without the sa, which is this one, means in its worst form, a perception of things as being self-existent. Thinking that something is self-existent. It's basically the same as dangjin. Okay? Dopa is looking at your boss and thinking that what you're seeing is coming from his side and not from your side. Okay? That's a dopa. Dokngen. Okay? It's a wrong idea. You can say wrong idea. So when he says, smash the skull of this, my enemy, he's saying, smash the skull in the sense of, smash these ideas that things are coming from their side, they're not. If you really get this, life becomes very, very frustrating. It's extremely frustrating to realize, as it's happening, that all the bad things happening to you are coming from yourself. It's very frustrating. And it's liberating, you see? Because then you can do something about it. If they were self-existent, says Arya Nagarjuna, you and I would be in deep trouble. Because then they could not be changed. You know, if your boss was really that bad and that nasty from his side, we'd be in trouble. Because he couldn't change it. You've tried to reason with him. You've tried to outfox him. You've tried to force him. You've tried to be sneaky with him. Nothing works. If he was self-existent out there, the way it seems, and if this is all that you can do to change him, we've already lost the battle. Life is going to go on like this. You will die, you will get old, you will lose everything you have, period. Can't change it. But because things are coming from your karma, and because they are a projection of your mind, everything becomes possible. Tantric paradise in this life becomes totally plausible and attainable. Okay? Because things are not coming from their own side, they're coming from you. Okay? Okay, next one. Not yet, Sykes. In the next few verses, which Dr. Sykes doesn't have, he says, let's use this wheel of knives on you now. Okay, he's talking to his enemy. He says, let's just see how it works on your face. Okay, and he starts to spin it, and he starts to call it Lekikorlo. Say Lekikorlo. Lekikorlo. He starts calling it the wheel of karma. Okay, I'll spell it for you. Say Leki Korlo. Leki Korlo. Le means karma, okay? In modern Tibetan it means work. It means to anything you ever do, anything you ever say, and everything you ever think is le. Okay? Leki Korlo means a wheel of karma. It's very interesting. This is the first time that he calls it the wheel of karma. Up to now, he's been calling it the wheel of knives. He says, let's see how you like to get your face cut up with this Lekikorlo. You know, let me use this, he says, let me use this wheel of knives, comma, this wheel of karma on you now. Let's see how you like it, okay? And this is a little bit touchy, okay? Do Buddhas collect karma? You know, do enlightened beings still collect karma? And this gets a little touchy. Can you turn the laws of karma back on this monster, you know, your enemy? Can you use his own weapon against him? That's the question here in the text. Can you use the wheel of knives on your own self-cherishing? Can you use the wheel of knives on your own ignorance? You know, that's a question. Can you do that? Can you turn the tables around and start slicing up his face with his own weapon? Okay. They say, yeah, okay, yeah. Okay, the same rules apply when you clean up samsara as when you made the mess, the original mess. Okay? You can use the same rules. Okay? What? Your enemy is not self-existent either. He is also a projection of your mind. And we're going to get that at the end. At the end, he's so into it, he says, your enemy doesn't exist at all. This self-cherishing and this perception of things as being existing from their own side, they don't even exist, and they never did. He gets really into it, you know. What it means is they don't exist from their own side. Okay? They also are your projections. If there's something about your mind that you don't like, you can use the same rules that you use to get rid of your ugly boss. Okay, any unpleasant event, internal or external, you can deal with it using Lake Korlo, the wheel of karma. You can use the same things against it. What? Find out what causes ignorance. Find out what causes self-cherishing. And take and do the steps you have to take to remove it. Okay? For self-cherishing, what's the best way you already know? Donglen. Okay? Exchanging yourself and others. What's the ultimate practice of it? Donglen. A breathing practice where you take away others' pain and give them happiness. Okay? It's very, very beautiful. It's very, very detailed. We have a 12-chapter course about it. You have to study it in detail. It's 100 pages of stuff to study to do it properly. Okay? And there is a course on it. So you have to do Tonglen. It's the ultimate way to stop that projection of your own mind being selfish. Okay? It will change the projection. What you use for ignorance is wisdom. Okay? And that you use the Diamond Cutter Sutra. Alright? You go read study the Diamond Cutter Sutra course. Okay? Those two things will change the projection in your own mind of that enemy. And you can turn the wheel of karma against its master. You know, you can use it on the other guy, as well as he's been using it on you. Okay? There's a technical detail here. Say, Tsongyi. Tsongyi. Tsongyi means, Tsok means a big collection of anything. Okay? Like when the monks at Saramea, 1,000 monks, go into the main temple and hold a prayer ceremony, that's called a Tsok. Okay? In fact, it's called a Tsokang or a Dukang, a big temple. The big, big temple where Sarajay and Saramea monks both meet is called the Tsokchen, the place for big Tsoks. Okay? So Tsok means when you get a whole bunch of stuff together. Tsokyi means two of them, two different kinds. As when we spoke about method and wisdom, if you use method, which is mainly the first four perfections, doing those over and over and over again, not getting angry at people, controlling your anger, keeping your vows nicely, giving things to other people, taking joy in doing good things. If you keep doing them over and over and over again, you start to collect together this incredible mass of energy that we no longer call karma. Okay? If you do it with wisdom, if you do it with an understanding of emptiness that we've talked about tonight, we don't call it karma anymore. We don't say Buddhas collect karma. We say they collect the Tsognyi. Okay? They gather the two Tsoks. Okay? What are the two Tsoks? Gewa Di, Gewa Gun, Sunam Yeshe Tsozoshing. Okay? The second line of the prayer that we do every single night. Okay, at the end, Sunam and Yeshe Tsok. Okay, the second line, Sunam Yeshe Tsozoshing. Okay, Sunam means good deeds, which in this case mainly means method. It mainly means not getting angry, keeping your vows well, being generous to other people, being joyful to do good deeds. If you keep doing that enough, you collect together what we call the collection of merit. Okay? The collection of merit. That turns you into physically a Buddha. Okay? That gives you the physical body of a Buddha. That changes the effect of that on your inner body, which you cannot see if you cut your body open. You have an inner body. You have a whole network inside that you can't see. You have a spiritual body. And as you collect more and more virtue, as you have more and more compassion, every time you understand one more little thing about emptiness, it starts to open up. The little channels inside covering your body, all throughout your body, start to open up a little more. Every time you help somebody, every time you have a kind thought towards someone, and especially every time you have an understanding of emptiness, a little bit more understanding of emptiness, they open up a little bit more. Okay? When they are not open, you must get old and die. When they open completely, you don't have to get old and die anymore. Okay? And the whole idea of the Sunam Kitsok is to change this body. It will change this body. Those good deeds done over a long period of time in a very powerful way will change this body into the body of an enlightened being. Okay? Of light. Okay? So we don't technically call it karma anymore at that point, okay? We don't say people collect karma to be a Buddha. It's not like that. They collect the two collections, okay? They create the two collections. What's the second collection? It's called wisdom. Okay, wisdom. It's meditating enough and having enough understandings of emptiness that eventually your mind transforms into a Buddha's mind. Okay? And that's the Sunamkutsok. So, you know, if somebody asks you, do Buddhas collect karma? You say, not really. But you can use the principle of karma to become a Buddha, and you can use that knife on that other guy. Okay? But technically, it's not going to be called the wheel of karma anymore. At that point, it becomes me collecting my holy angel's body and my holy angel's mind. I'm collecting the energy to do that. And we don't call it karma anymore. Okay? In the higher schools. Okay? In the lower schools, they have an idea of a pure and impure karma, and that's another thing. Okay? Same idea. Okay, one more thing, and we'll take a break. Sykes, you don't have this one either. I have to find it first. Let me see. I'll read you the lines, okay? These are almost at the end of the Lojong. He's close to the end. He says, and for whatever time remains in the days before myself and those who are my parents have reached our enlightenment in the heaven below no other. This is a special paradise. May all of us, as we wander together, driven by karma through six worlds, love and cherish one another. Love and cherish each other as one. So he's making a prayer, you know, like, if I keep this kind of stuff up, I'm going to get enlightened sooner or later. I will reach a Buddha paradise. In the meantime, bless me to have the strength to love the people around me. Okay? Then he says, and in those days as well may I find the strength to dwell alone within the three realms of misery, if this would be of service to a single other being. So now he's making a prayer. He's saying, if it would help a single other person, I would be willing to go to hell. You know, I would personally be willing to go down to hell or go live in New York City if it would help a single other being. You know, I would move from my happy home where I'm completely satisfied and I would go to some lousy place if that would help somebody else. Okay? May I find the strength to never give up this bodhisattva behavior. May I draw into my being the suffering all those feel in the three lower realms of pain. So he's like praying that he could suck out the suffering from other living beings. Okay. Now he's talking about what it's going to be like when he gets to hell in the service of a single other being. And in the very moment after I arrive in the realms of hell, may the hell guards look upon me and see me their holy lama. May the rain of weapons they release upon me turn to a shower of blooms before they land. May I stand untouched. May peace and bliss then spread throughout my heart. Okay. This is something we talked about last time. Okay, it's the idea people have that bodhisattvas would go to hell for other people. You know, and that's, is it possible? You know, we have to talk about it. And is he being poetic or is he being real? You see, if a bodhisattva who kept up this kind of behavior long enough wanted to go to hell, could they? Can't. Okay? Can't. Why? Because hell is a creation of bad karma. They don't have any more bad karma. Okay? Get this. There ain't no hell that's not created by bad karma. And they can't go to somebody else's hell. You see what I mean? Your hell is created by your bad karma, and my hell is created by my bad karma. I can't go to your hell, and you can't go to my hell. We can go to hell together. But that hell will be a projection that's going, two projections going on at once. It's really two different projections going on at once. It happens to be a very similar projection, but not exactly the same ever. You know, you're experiencing generally the same realm. The guards are cutting you up a little differently than they're cutting me up, okay? And that's a slightly different perception of the same thing, okay? I can't go to hell for you, okay? That part is a metaphor, okay? That part is like, yeah, they would love to go to hell for you. And the point is, they really would be willing to go to hell for you. But every time they try, what happens? What did Yang Gumba say at the end of his poem. On his deathbed, and he was dying, he yelled out. You know, everybody's standing there watching him. Oh, Lama's dying, you know, and he goes, wait a minute, you know. And anyways, I'm trying to get to hell to help all sentient beings. But every time I try, I just keep seeing more paradises. You know, like every time he gets the feeling that he's on his deathbed, he's praying to go to hell to help somebody. And every time he does the prayer, more gates, more paradises open up before his eyes, and he's reporting it to his students as he dies. You know, and that was really the way he died. Okay, so is it possible that someone could throw knives at you, or throw spears at you? You know, or say something bad to you, or do something wrong to you, and before that thing reached you, it turned into a rain of flowers, of blooms. Is it possible? Of course. That's what's happening. It's exactly what's happening. The thing that happened under the Bodhi tree when the Buddha was getting enlightened ain't no metaphor. They wanted to hurt him. They did everything they could do to hurt him. And every time they thought of something nasty to do to him, before it reached him, it's turning into this bliss. You know, it's turning into flowers. The point is, I can't hurt you even if I want to hurt you. Okay? You can't hurt another person, and they can't hurt you. It's impossible. Okay? If you had your karmic act together, and if everybody else in this room wanted to hurt you, you would just think it was the nicest, sexiest thing that ever happened to you. Ooh! Do more. That's great. You know, do it over there. You see what I mean? Because they are not self-existent. They are coming from you. And if your karma was clean, then every time, and I tell it to you honestly, okay, I tell you the truth. The things that you think now people are doing to hurt you, when you improve your karma, the exact same people doing the exact same thing, you will think it's some kind of plot to help you. And it will be. You see what I mean? In those days when you thought they were trying to hurt you, were you right? Yep. And later on, after you cleaned out their karma and they did the same thing to you, were they trying to help you? Right. So is it not a contradiction for one action from another person, one in the same action to you on two different occasions, to be totally bad on one side and totally nice on the other side? Totally possible. That's the emptiness of the action. That's the emptiness of the action. And I tell you, it's really, really interesting that the things that made you irritated, the people that bothered you, the events that used to bother you, you will start to perceive them as the sweetest, holiest, most beautiful things that ever happened to you. It's weird. It's really weird. But ain't that the way karma works? And ain't that the way emptiness works, okay? And then sometimes you'll be on the fence seeing it both ways. And then you go do a little bit better karma and then suddenly it flops over on the right side of the fence. You know what I mean? And that's what it's like to live in a world where nothing is real. That's what it's like to live in a world where nothing is coming from itself. As you improve your karma and your behavior and keep your vows more and more, those events will actually transform. The same thing done to you a week later will feel great. Okay? It's very exciting. It's very cool to watch it happen. Yeah. Yeah, she said she said that I said like, if you go to hell, it's true that every being in hell right now did something similar. So they're in what we call a realm. But get this, a realm is nothing more than their collective experiences. There is no realm. There is no hell realm. There's a place where millions of beings are perceiving each one of them, themselves, being tortured. And that's what hell is. There is no separate realm. You had the reading, right, a couple weeks ago? Upali, the sutra requested by Upali. It's not like Joe Schmo Construction Company went and built hell. Of course, hell is the collective perceptions of every being in hell. And that's all the hell there is. As soon as the last person doesn't have to go to hell anymore, there won't be any hell. Because nobody will be seeing hell. Because that's all hell is. Okay? And each person in hell is experiencing it a little bit differently in the way that each person in this room is experiencing me a little bit differently. Some people smiling, some people laughing, some people snoring, some people yawning, some people watching their watches, okay? Everyone's having a different karma ripen at this moment. She said, is it the same in Buddha paradises? That's true, it is the same. You know, each Buddha maintains their individuality. Each Buddha has their own Buddha paradise. Qualitatively, their bliss is the same. Qualitatively, they're having the same bliss. You know, but they have slight distinctions. They are each experiencing it as an individual. But remember that they're all experiencing every event that ever was, ever will be, and is now. So almost quantitatively, they're also experiencing the same stuff. But they are still individuals, and they don't mix into one being. Why? That's the nature of how karma is stored and collected. You know, it's what an individual is the continuation of karma. Okay? So they still have their identity. There's still 35 Buddha confession and 1001 Buddhas, and they are still separate beings. Okay? So it is possible to turn weapons into flowers, and it will happen to you. And the events that you find hurt you now, you know, somebody cheating you, somebody stealing your girlfriend, you know, somebody lying to you, somebody screaming at you, all of these events will turn into some holy thing happening to you that you really like. And you'll see them as a completely different thing. And they are the same event. Exactly. But your karma has changed. And your projections have changed. Okay? See in about 5-10 minutes. Okay? Two things. Tuesday night's class will be... There'll be also some real class. It's not just a review class. Okay? The first half will be two more very, very short lojongs that I didn't have the heart to leave out, okay? These are, one is called a lojong that was granted to Lord Adisha by two angels who told him, you better get a good heart. And that's the title of it. The other one is called a lojong passed down through Sumba Lhotsawa. Sumba Lhotsawa was a Tibetan who went to India to learn to translate the holy books into Tibetan. He spent years there. And in those days, classes were an expensive proposition. You had to take a bag of gold dust and offer it to the guru. And oftentimes they would take out the dust and just throw it in the air, signifying that they don't need it and they don't want it. But from the student's side, it was important to sacrifice something. So there was this give and take thing. And he had a bag of gold when he got to India, and he spent it slowly, he gave it away to lamas, and then at the end he had a little bit left, so he had enough money to go down to Bodh Gaya, and he went down to see the stupa at Bodh Gaya, and he still has some questions, philosophical questions that he didn't get straightened out, and he's like wondering about what to do and what it was, and these two ladies show up at the stupa and start walking around and sometimes taking a break and sometimes walking around, and they start talking. Like, they're just two old ladies gossiping, you know. And then suddenly, he realizes that they are giving him a message, you know. And you see, it's that thing of his own goodness in studying with all those Indian masters is making these two ordinary, or are they ordinary, women seem like somebody special. And then slowly, all his final answers are... questions are answered in that moment of those ladies walking around. He's just list over... What do you call it? He's like eavesdropping on these two ladies, and all his final questions are answered, and he goes back to Tibet happy. So this is the, these are the two. We're going to do two very sweet little lojongs next on Tuesday, because class 8 was just a zero. There will not be any class 8. There's no class 8. Okay, all right. Oh, the other thing is, last class I asked you, you know, if you would help, if anybody wanted to help with Rinpoche's, the scriptures that we offered to Rinpoche, they cost exactly $1,000. We already had the money. I said, if you wanted any good karma, throw in $5-$10 and you can steal some of Leon's good karma. We collected $989 in about 10 minutes. And I threw in the other 11 with some of my friends because we wanted to catch some of the virtue. And I wanted to thank you for that. And Leon, when we told him, he was really... I told him he could do the shipping or something. But anyway, thank you very much. It was beautiful. It was really a beautiful offering. And he's very, very happy. He's like a kid with some new toys. And I haven't seen him like that for a long time. And it's about the only thing that he would sit there all day like a kid with a bunch of toys. So that was really, really beautiful. And thanks for leaving 11 for me. Okay. All right. Poor Sykes hasn't had anything to do for a while. You want to read one that you didn't practice? Okay, here you go. Do it slow.
Think now, everything we see is something that happens from something else. Understanding that everything comes from something else is to see that nothing exists by itself alone. Things come, things go, but nothing is what it seems. Everything is an illusion. The face in a mirror is no face itself. When you spin a burning stick and see a solid crimson circle, it's only as real as an image seen in a looking glass.
Wait, I need that one. Okay. So what he's saying here, I mean, you hear people say, oh, Buddhism says everything is an illusion. Here he says, and here in the next verse he says, things come, things go, but nothing is what it seems. Everything is an illusion. The face in the mirror is no face itself. And that's the idea that it looks, you know, like a young child or an animal, when they see a face in a mirror, they sometimes mistake it for the real person. And that's the idea of an illusion. Then he says, there's this idea in Buddhism, you take a brand, meaning a torch, and you go like this, real fast. And it looks like there's one circle of light, you know, and it looks solid. But it's really just that the arm is moving so fast that it's the illusion of solidity. And that's another example in Buddhism for illusion. Later on he says fog banks are like that. You know, they look like this huge thing coming into town, and when they get there, it's all around you and you can't see anything anymore. And there's no solidity to it. Okay, and he keeps talking like that. But look how he starts out the verse, okay? And the point is, the text, the Lojong here, as we enter the last part of it, the last few paragraphs, it gets very sexy. It gets really cool. You know, he starts talking really mystical. You know, nothing exists. There's no this, there's no that. Nothing matters. You can practice, you can don't practice. Don't try to think too much. You can't understand anything. It's all beyond, you know. And then people get this kind of stuff. You know, they forget the first 80 pages about morality, and they grasp onto that last line, you know. Nothing matters. Nothing is anything. There's no here or there. Everything's the same. Doesn't matter whether you practice or you don't practice, okay? And you must, because you are going to be teachers of the next generation. I mean, in this group are sitting 10 or 15 people or more who will have their own Dharma centers. They'll be like that Sakya guy who started his own little Dharma center, which became the biggest monastery of his time. There will be people like that in this room. You have to be careful with these lines. I even hesitate to give them to you. You know what I mean? You have to explain them clearly to people. Okay? Don't forget what he said at the beginning. I don't know if you noticed. Here's the first few lines before he got sexy. Okay? Think now, everything we see is something that happens from something else. Understanding that everything comes from something else is to see that nothing exists by itself alone. That he's giving you the clue there. He says, when I say nothing exists, I mean nothing exists that doesn't come from something else. Okay? When I say there's nothing to practice, I mean there's nothing to practice that doesn't come from something else. When I say that monster doesn't even exist, your enemy doesn't exist, and you don't exist, and your world doesn't exist, and my book doesn't exist, what I mean is they are nothing that doesn't come from something else. He's saying everything comes from something else. This is the Buddhist idea of dependent origination. In the highest schools, it means everything is coming from your mind. Your mind is projecting all these events. That's the highest meaning of dependent origination. That is the meaning of dependent origination. Your boss is empty. Whether you see that boss as good or whether you see that boss as mean is only coming from one place, and that's your mind. Okay? So that's all. On that basis, he's like an illusion. You might mistake and take him for really bad, but he's not really bad any more than your face in the mirror is really your face, or any more than that solid circle is solid. It's not. Okay? And that's what that's all he's saying. The homework's going to say, what reason does he use to say all things are an illusion? And you have to say, everything comes from something else. And meaning, this whole world is a production of my projections forced on me by past karma. That's all. Okay? Which boils down in a practical sense to nothing happens to you all day long that you don't like, that you did not create yourself. And if you don't like it, start keeping your vows. Start keeping your book. All the people who come to me and tell me how miserable they are and how lousy their practice is, I'm always saying, how's your book going? They say, well, I don't have time to do that. So I'm like, well, don't come to me. I get pissed off sometimes. I'm like, don't come to me anymore. I don't want to hear about it, you know. Keep your book. It'll change. Keep your vows. Things will change. You know, don't come and tell me, oh, I don't feel so good. Things aren't working. Why? I mean, it boils down to I'm not keeping my vows. I don't even know what they are, and I don't check them regularly, okay? Of course you'll be unhappy. Don't come and confess it to me, okay? Okay, next one. It's the question in the homework says, Master Dhammarakshita says of the enemy himself that, quote, he is not there at all. He seems to be real, so very real, but nothing is real at all. Does this mean that our tendency to see things as self-existent doesn't exist at all? Okay? He says the enemy doesn't exist. The enemy is your tendency to misunderstand things. Of course it exists. How does it exist? Exactly the same way your boss. Exactly the same as your boss. You created that ignorance also. In the same way you created your boss and everything else you don't like in the world. Okay? You created your very ignorance, and you can change it. Ignorance, the mental state of not understanding emptiness, has its own emptiness, okay? The mental state of not understanding emptiness has its own emptiness. And that's why you can change it, okay? Then he says something else. It's really beautiful. He says, let me read it to you. Saksh, you want to do this one? Start here and go to the next page. Slow.
Think of filling a water pitcher with single drops of water. The pitcher isn't filled up. When the first drop drops, neither is it the last that fills it, nor any other of the drops alone. It's when the whole is done, when things that come from others have come from the others, that the pitcher is filled. It's just the same whenever we experience the result of our previous actions. Whether it's pleasure or pain, it is not the first instant of the cause that brings us the result. Nor is it the last or one of the rest. It's when the whole is done, when things that come from others have come from the others, that we feel the pain or pleasure. And so I beg you, be careful. Do those things that you should, and give up those things you shouldn't, if only in a movie.
Okay. Okay, the point is this. It's a very obscure verse, and I want you to understand it because it's a very beautiful verse. Okay? It says, if you took a big water pitcher and you filled it up with water drop by drop, it's not the first drop that fills the pitcher, and it's not any of the in-between drops, and it's not even the last drop that fills the pitcher. The pitcher is filled when all the drops have come together. Okay, and this is the idea where Arya Nagarjuna, Master Nagarjuna, he says, look, things are not their parts. Things are not the sum of the parts. Things are not both the parts and the sum of the parts. But things ain't neither the parts nor the sum of the parts either. Okay, I'll say it again. Things are not the parts. Things are not their parts. A. B. Things are not all the parts together. C. Things are not both their parts and all the parts together. And D. Things are neither, they're not either, not their parts, and not the whole. All of those are impossible. All permutations are impossible. Okay? Which doesn't make sense, right? One of them has to be true. And here in Dharmarakshita is also saying, you drop all the drops of drop into the pitcher, but the pitcher's not full by any one of the drops. It's all the drops, it's when all the drops are together. And then he says, your world is the same. When dependent origination is completed, then things exist. And until that time, they don't. Okay? What does it mean? You know, what's the comparison? What does he mean when he's talking about drops of water in a pitcher, and then he starts talking about your perceptions, your projections? And this is very important. When Nagarjuna says, by the way, is a thing the sum of its parts? Of course it is. Okay? Is a car a tire? No. Is a car both a tire and all the other parts together? I shouldn't say it that way. Is a car both the tire by itself, A, and also the sum of its parts? No. Is it neither the tire alone nor all the parts together? No. Well, what is it? It's all the parts together, dumbhead. Get all the parts together, the car works, that's it. The car is the sum of its parts. Why did Nagarjuna and everybody since him say the car is not the sum of its parts? Why is Dharmarakshita saying when you put all these parts into a glass of water, it's not until a certain fullness is reached can you say that it's a pitcher of water? And those drops are not filling the pitcher. Why is it true that the sum of the parts is not the whole? Why is it true that a car is not the sum of 5,000 different parts correctly put together with gas and insurance? Okay? Why can he say that?
Because if one part is missing, it'd still be a car.
No, it's not like that. It's not like, oh, you can take the gas cap off it, it's still running. Huh? Oh, assuming it works. I'm assuming it works. But the point is, she said, one thing is missing. One part is still missing. When you put those 5,000 parts together and you set them all together, properly assembled with gas and insurance, okay? One part is still missing, and that's your perception of it as a working car. And if that part's missing, those sum of those parts is not a whole. And you have to get that. Prove it. A guy from Alaska, 6th century BC, who walks into your garage, does not see a car. Okay? That's all. Until you think of it as a car, until you know how to use it as a car, until your karma is forcing you to know how to use it as a car, it's not a car. One part is still missing. Your karma is not forcing you to perceive it and to utilize it as a car. That's all. And that's what he means by the drops of water thing. Okay, you got to cook it. But that's a big help for those of you who got a headache, Michael, from Jeffrey Hopkins' big book, okay? Because it wasn't, you know, you have to make sure that's clear. Of course it's not true to say things are not the sum of their parts. They are the sum of their parts. But only after you've had the karma to see them as a whole thing working. And until then, there's still one part missing, which is your karma forcing you to see it that way. Okay? That's all. That's the thing about the drops. Okay, we got number 6, Dr. Sykes.
There is no wheel of karma here at all. Nothing is anything. Nothing is this or that. It looks like the moon itself is floating in your teacup. The things we do and their consequences float by in the multitude of the things in the world around us. I beg you now, be careful. Do the things you should, give up the things you shouldn't, if only in a movie.
Okay, so now we get to a pretty heavy line. We are close to the end of the Lojong, okay? And it's 9:20. I got like 9 minutes, okay? He says, there is no wheel of karma here at all. There is no wheel of knives. Nothing is anything. Nothing is this or that. And then he talks about, you look into your teacup and you can see the moon. Okay? Is the moon in your teacup? No, okay? Why does it look like the moon is in your teacup? Ah, conditions are complete. All right? Dependent origination has fulfilled itself. There's a nice, smooth body of water, even if it's a tiny one, but it's not moving. It's still. And there's a nice big autumn moon up there, and the angle of refraction is right, and you see a reflection in the teacup. Is there a moon in the teacup? No. Does there appear to be a moon in the teacup? Yes. Okay? And he says, your whole world is the same as the moon in the teacup. And you keep going around thinking that that's a real moon. You think your boss is bad from his side, and you get angry at him, which makes you see another bad boss about 2 weeks later. Don't you get it yet? Okay? Got it? Just stop it. All right? And that's the whole thing. He says, you're trying to put a lunar lander in your teacup, you know. Forget it. The boss is not coming from his side. It's you. Every bad person you ever meet is you. So just stop it, okay? Every time somebody hurts you, it's you. It's the wheel of knives. Just stop it, okay? Okay. Then he says something very heavy. He says, and by the way, he says this over and over again. Towards the end of the text, he starts to get into another mood. It's like the monster is starting to calm down a little bit, you know, like the hair is starting to, it's like Wolfman coming back, okay? And he says, I beg you now, be careful. Do the things you should and give up the things you shouldn't, if only in a movie, okay? Somebody asked me, were there movies in 1100 AD? I said, not really, okay? He said something like a false play. You see what I mean? And what he's saying is that the whole idea about the moon and the teacup proves one thing. You have to keep your vows. And you have to never break your vows. Okay? It's very beautiful. Normally you hear people explaining it wrong. Totally poisonous wrong. Because things are empty, you can do whatever the hell you want. Total poison. Okay? Because things are an illusion, you must do good deeds. Why? They create the illusion. And the illusion can hurt you bad. Okay? When your foot breaks, when your arm breaks, when you pull your back out of joint, it's an illusion, but it hurts. And it's no fun. And if you don't want to just go on anymore, you have to stop and keep your vows. And you have to do it every 2 hours, and you have to check them, okay? Every 2 hours. And you have to write something specific and don't say, oh, I'm not such a good person or something like that, okay? No, at 3:05 today, when I saw this person with that person, I was unhappy for 2 minutes. It's got to be something like that, okay? That's why he says, if only in a movie, right? You have to be good, you have to not be bad, even though you're dealing with illusions, even though you're in a world of illusion, you have to be good and bad. I mean, Jetsun Kapa would have said, because you're in the movie, you have to be good, okay? Not if only, all right? Jetsun Kapa was a lot tougher on this point. He would say, because the world around you is the Truman Show, you must be moral, okay? Because everything around you is totally illusory, now it's time to keep your vows, okay? And you have to teach it that way, all right? Okay, last thing. Sykes, number 7. This is the last verse. I expect a good round of applause from Dr. Sykes. Okay.
Neither the things that the mind perceive nor the mind itself have any real nature of their own. There is nothing you should practice. There is nothing you should give up. Strip everything of your perceptions. Leave your mind as it came, from the beginning that never was. Don't confuse things by trying to understand them. Live in the place called as it is, and then you will become a high and holy being. I want to thank the Academy of Arts and Sciences. I want to thank my director, Lord Buddha Shakyamuni, my producer, Geshe Lobsang Chimsen, everybody at Rashi Gyempo Ling, my mom, all the Sangha for putting up with me. Thank you.
Oh boy. Thank you, Dr. All right. Okay, last verse. Perfect verse for creating a non-dharma, okay? Perfect verse for confusing generation after generation of future Buddhists, okay? Forget all the 15 courses of nice, strict Buddhism you've had and go around teaching this verse. It's much easier, okay? Neither the things that the mind perceives nor the mind itself have any real nature of their own. There is nothing you should practice. There is nothing you should give up. Strip everything of your perceptions. Leave your mind as it came from the beginning that never was. Don't confuse things by trying to understand them. Live in the place called as it is, and then you will become a high and holy being. Okay? I mean, those very, very dangerous lines. Okay? And I think they have misled many people in the past. Seems like they have misled many people in the past. Okay? And your last homework question is, explain those lines. All right? There is nothing you should practice means what? Come on, it's always the same trick. No, too easy. There is nothing you should practice that comes from its own side. Okay? There is no dharma that exists in the universe that's not being created by you. I keep talking about your boss, but you also created His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Thank you. Okay? If His Holiness is in this world, if Ken Rinpoche is still here, it's because you're good enough for them to be here because you are creating them. You know, thank you for that. Okay? That's all. There's nothing you should practice means you would never meet the Dharma. You would never hear about the Quaker House. There wouldn't be any classes in New York City if your mind didn't have an extraordinary amount of virtue in it. You are creating these classes. Okay? And that's really cool. Okay, that's what the line means. Okay, strip everything of your projections means try to understand how everything is your projections. Okay, try to understand the role that your own karma is playing all around you all the time. Everything you like, everything you don't like is coming from your karma. Okay, leave your mind as it came from the beginning that never was. Oh yeah? Okay. My mind happens to be a very unpleasant place to live at times. Okay? I don't want to leave it like it was from the beginning. Okay? What he means is something in Buddhism called the primordial state. Okay? And some schools of Buddhism teach that your mind has been pure from the beginning, but you just can't see it. That's not true. Okay? At all. Your mind's not pure at all. If you think it is, you know, come visit my mind for a while. You know, it's not. It's really not, and you know that. It makes you miserable. It makes you depressed. It makes you want things that you can't have. It makes you dissatisfied the minute you get what you did want. The mind is no happy place to be, and it has been that way forever. From no beginning, it's been like that. What this verse means is learn to recognize the emptiness of your mind, which is pure and has been pure from the beginning. Okay? The fact that your own mind is also your projection is what gives you hope to become a Buddha. You see? If your mind was not your own projection, you'd be stuck with it forever. But because your mind is your projection, and that's been the case forever, now there's hope that you can turn it into an enlightened being's mind. Okay? The emptiness of your mind, which is what we call the Buddha nature of you, the emptiness of your mind, it gives the hope, it gives the possibility that you can become a Buddha. Okay? That's all. That's what that line means. Live in the place called as it is. Okay? Live in the place called as it is. As it is means the real nature of things, okay? Which is that they are a collaboration of karma and emptiness. Okay? Never forget those two. I sometimes call it the marriage of karma and emptiness. You know, very sweet when two things get married forever. Karma and emptiness. Okay? Your boss is empty of any quality of being good or bad. Your karma is forcing you to see him one way or the other. Okay? And that's all. That's the meaning of those lines. And you have to explain them correctly, or else some poor guy will get a hold of these lines and swear for 10 or 20 years that he doesn't have to practice anything. I have met many ruined people who got these teachings 15 years ago, 20 years ago. You know, I have one calling me as we speak. He's in jail for, you know, his lama said, oh, everything's empty, you know, do what you like. You know, and he's in jail under charges for something like 6 years for some kind of bad behavior, you know. And it's not like that, you know. It's really bad to give that to people and not explain it properly. Because everything is an illusion, you must keep your vows, okay? That's what it really means. That's about it. Let me see. Yeah, that's how he ends the lojong, okay? He ends it on emptiness. He ends it on the teaching on emptiness. Then he gives a little bit of the lineage. The person who wrote it down, that we don't know who he is, gives you a little bit of the lineage. So at the very end, you'll see who passed it down to whom throughout the years. And just about every great lama is in there. Okay? So that's the end of that lojong. Please keep it in your mind. And you have to be like that. Okay? First half of the lojong of the Wheel of Knives is waking up and realizing that everything is coming from you. And then in the second half, you know, get pissed off and go, you know, cut him up a little bit. You know, who? Your own self-cherishing and your own misunderstanding of emptiness. Okay, go beat him up. Go smash his face. Go cut him a little bit with the wheel of karma, right? And that's very powerful. Sometimes when you have a very... this is a trick, okay? When you have a very bad emotion, if you get very of anger or depressed, or you have some kind of jealousy going on in your mind, do a you dance, okay? I mean, like, it's really good, you know? You visualize yourself as this being who could rip out this guy's heart with his hands, you know? And you just get like 2 feet taller and a foot wider, and you just try to get into the mode of this being who could just stand there and rip this guy's heart out, okay? And it's very beautiful. You know, sometimes the right thing to do when you have a mental affliction is to be calm and peaceful. And then sometimes you should get into like a wrathful mode, you know, like, I'm going to take my own selfishness and rip his heart out. And then just enjoy it, and you just turn into this powerful being. And it's very, very beautiful. It really works, okay? Sometimes... especially when things are confusing, you know, when a mental affliction is making you confused and making you like, I don't know how to say, like you're not quite sure what to do or something like that, then change modes into this monster, you know, and just rip his face out, all right? Okay, nice, sweet thing. Sāshīya-bhūrgī-śaśe-netā-śaṁ Rīrāvīṁśī-nyam-de-yam-pādī-sāṁ-de-śīndu-mitte-gu-vāgī-drukur-nāmbā-śīvā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-śivā-
This is the end of Class 10. You have been listening to Lojong, Developing the Good Heart with Geshe Michael Roach, presented by the Asian Classics Institute. The Asian Classics Institute is dedicated to preserving the pure teachings and practice of Buddhism. For a listing of other topics available, write to the Asian Classics Institute, P.O. Box 20373, New York, New York, 10009, or call 212-475-7752.